In your notes, the next note is the release and doom of Satan. What happens in Revelation 20:10 is, I'll read it, the devil who deceived them was cast in the lake of fire. What happens is, Satan is put into this pit, and for 1,000 years, the earth sees God at work with no demons and Satan interfering. Heaven is briefly kind of coming to earth. Ezekiel tells us that a 7 mile by 7 mile, that's 49 square mile, temple compound is built in Jerusalem. It becomes a huge world kind of resort that everybody comes to. Now God in Isaiah says, if you won't come once a year to his temple where you hear about God, the temple is where you come, they go back to having sacrifices. Did you know that? That's Ezekiel 40:48. They're doing the animal sacrifices over again in this temple in the millennium. And people go, that can't be right. Why not? What's the Lord's Supper? The Lord's Supper is me looking back at Jesus dying on the cross. The Lord's Supper is not crucifying Christ. It's me looking back that it happened. What were all of the Old Testament sacrifices in the Old Testament time? What were the sacrifices that Cain, that Abel offered, that were offered by Noah after the flood, that were offered all the way through the Mosaic ones? They were looking forward to Christ's coming. Did anybody get saved by killing an animal? No. It's by obediently trusting in a sacrifice. So those Old Testament sacrifices never have been salvific. They never have saved people. And so God isn't saving people by the sacrifices. He's displaying what Christ did on the cross in this giant temple. If you don't come to the temple once a year, it doesn't rain on your little farm. It actually says that in Isaiah. And if you stay on your little farm that it's not raining on and going, I am against God, he'll only let you be that way for 100 years, and then he cuts you off. Because it says that those who rebel will be cut off, and they'll be like mere infants because they only live 100 years. It's amazing everything going on. I don't have enough time. That's 10% of the Old Testament is all about what's going on in the millennium. But basically, through all that time, the world gets bigger and bigger. The population grows and grows because there's no poisonous animals. People aren't dying of pollution and cancer and car accidents, and there are no murders. And it's just, whoa, and no one dies. They live the whole 1,000 years. As long as you go along with it, go over to the temple and walk around a little bit, it rains on your little property, and you eat, and you live under your vine, and your kids aren't sick, and they get married, and you have tons of grandchildren. But then Satan, in verse 10, is released. And, I mean, he's thrown in the pit in verse 10. Let me get to it. But Satan is released, and it says he goes out, and he deceives the whole world. There, verse 7. When the 1,000 years have been expired, Satan will be released. He'll deceive the nations, and he gathers them all together, and they all march toward the temple. And God says, enough is enough. And he incinerates the people and throws the devil into the lake of fire. Why is this important? Because of what it says in verse 9. Look what it says in Revelation 20, verse 9. And they went up the breadth of the earth. All those people that God rained on and kept well and didn't let them get bit by snakes and eaten by any carnivorous animal and all that, they never got murdered or raped or anything because the world was under his rule. They surround the camp of the saints. What is it called where the saints live? The camp. What does that mean? It means that as people become true believers, they can't get enough of God. They move from wherever they live on the earth to be right by Jerusalem's 49-square-mile temple. They camp so they can be near the place where the presence of God is most evident and visible and manifested. And so all the believers start leaving wherever they're from, and one of their trips through that 49-square-mile millennial temple, this young person says, wow, that's the God of the universe. I want to love and follow him. And they say, who are all those people living over there? And they go, oh, those are all the saints. They camp here. They stay as close as they can to God. Well, I'm going to stay here too. And so slowly all believers get identified. All the normal people see the tribulation ends and only the people that haven't rebelled and joined the beast survive. Everyone else is killed. So there are survivors of the tribulation. They're believers from all over the world. And they enter. So everybody that enters the millennium is a believer. But they have kids and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Can you imagine 1,000 years of having, you know, humans? It's like just before the flood. The earth had more than 1 billion people in Noah's day, most likely, if you count all those generations. But the descendants of the believers don't necessarily become believers. Just because your parents are Christians, you're not. Just because your grandparents are Christian, you're not. You have to embrace and receive Christ. So the vast majority of the world doesn't follow Christ. They follow the devil. But look how they live in this camp. And I wrote, heaven is home, life is camping. That's what it says in 2 Peter 1, 13-14. Peter said, I live in a tent. You see, a tent is a temporary abode. And the hymn, this world is not my home, I'm just passing through. And the concept from Hebrews 11, pilgrims and strangers, is what God always wants. In your notes, the next thing is that 10% of the Bible. It's a summary of all the Old Testament millennial promises. And what's interesting is this shows up in Acts 15. It's in your notes. I'll read it to you, starting verse 14. Simon, that's Peter, has declared how God at the first visited the Gentiles to take out for them a people for his name, and with the words of the prophets agree, just as it is written. Now it's talking about this. After this, I will return and build the tabernacle of David, which has fallen down. That is a huge statement. After this, after the Gentiles are called out, after the church age, after the rapture, the millennium is a time when God rebuilds and Israel becomes the center of the world. Jerusalem, where this plaza is, it just becomes kind of the place to be. And it says, and I will set it up so the rest of mankind may seek the Lord. Wow. The whole purpose of the millennium is to get as many of those people possible saved. These truths should bring us hope. Hebrews 2:14 says that Jesus Christ destroyed him that had the power of death so that we should no longer live our lives in fear of death. We are supposed to, there's another great verse in Hebrews chapter 7, and it says, we live after the power of an endless life. It should be evident in our lives that we belong to Christ. I was going to a men's retreat a while back, and as a pastor, my life is so full, I wasn't ready for the men's retreat. It was out of state. It was a couple of airplane flights away. So I went on the flight with my Bible and my notes, and I was furiously working on what I was going to speak on. And it was curious. When I got on the plane, it was a Delta flight. When I got on, there was nobody in the waiting room. And I thought, this is funny. And I went up to the counter. I said, you really having the flight? They said, yeah, that's a repaired plane. They just fixed it, and we're just shipping it out of here, and you might be the only one on the flight. I said, wow. How many stewardesses? They said, three. I said, so I'll get lots of drinks and not be bothered. They said, yes. So I was so excited, and they were bringing me, you know, my cranberry juice, and I was sitting there. I had my Bible out, and finally they said, we're taking off. I put my Bible away, and just before we took off, someone ran onto the plane. That's okay. I'll share it. You know, there were like 120 seats. Guess where they sat? Right across the aisle from me. I thought, but the plane took off, and as soon as it took off, I put a little tray down. I kind of turned in my seat so I wouldn't look at them, and I kept working on my lesson. And they kept pushing their call button, you know, that little beep, and the stewardess runs up. And they were asking for those little tiny bottles of alcohol. They sell for $3 like a shot of something. Not beer, really strong alcohol. Beep. Beep, about the third beep, and he kind of got happy over there. And he leaned back in his seat, and he says, hey, what are you doing over there on the other side of the aisle? I put my finger where I was in the Bible, and I said, and glanced over him, I said, I'm studying the Bible. Turned a little bit more my back to him and started working on my sermon. Beep. He says, hey. I mean, after about 5 minutes, drank his next little shot. He said, hey, you teach the Bible, I have a question. So I put my finger where I was, and I turned in my seat. And it was so clear by my body language, my facial expression, that you were bothering me and you're a big interruption. You're half drunk, carrying on, and I'm trying to study the Bible. And I said, yes, what's your question? You know, with a fake smile. He said, his name was Paul, this guy. He said, my Hispanic housekeeper, I thought, you're rich enough to have a Hispanic housekeeper. Wow. Thought less of him. He's a drunk and he's some pompous aristocrat, you know. And I said, he said, my Hispanic housekeeper only says one thing to me. The only thing she knows in English. I said, what is it? And he said, she looks at me and says, you go hell. You go hell. He said, why would my Hispanic housekeeper repeatedly point at me and say, you go hell? I'm still sitting here with my finger on the verse, looking at him, and I said, because you probably are. And I turned in my seat, my back to him. And I started working, and it was like right then, if the Holy Spirit has one, he hit me with a baseball bat. Like, you pray all day long to share the gospel, and I sent you on a flight where there's only two people, and he sits by you, and he's so afraid of dying that he drinks the whole time, so he's not afraid of flying, because he's afraid of dying, and he thinks the plane might crash, so that's why he was drinking all those little bottles. And I sent a Hispanic housekeeper to him because he's a very wealthy Roman Catholic. His uncle happens to be the cardinal or the archbishop of Baltimore. And he is scared to death to die. And his Hispanic housekeeper does not speak English and just says, you go hell. That's all she could say. So I put him next to you on the plane with your open Bible. And you turn your back on him. Well, I felt really bad. And I turned right around and came right over to his side, and I said, let me explain to you what your Hispanic housekeeper said. And as the plane was landing, I had finished sharing the gospel, and I pulled out of my wallet that little gospel tract. I'd asked God for an appointment, and I handed it to him. And I wrote my name on the back of it and my phone number, and I said, this is the plan of salvation. You need to trust Christ. Found out he was a very wealthy doctor, an anesthesiologist, had 20 anesthesiologists working for him. He was going on a big game hunting expedition and was scared to death to fly, and God put him on my flight, and he went that way and I went this way. We were in Cincinnati, and I was going Covington, Kentucky, I guess, and I was going this way to Boston, and he was going that way to big game hunt. And I said, what's your name? He said, Paul. I said, Paul what? Bevilacqua. I said, boy, that's a mouthful. And I wrote that in my prayer journal. I says, I'm going to pray that you come to know the Lord. Never saw him again. About 3 months later, I was going to, between services, there are two services at church, and I was going to second service, and I was looking at my notes like this, and someone was in front of me, so I moved over here, and I kept walking. They moved over, so I moved back over. It's, you know, one of those little dances you do when you don't look up. And finally, it was like, the two-step three times, and I looked up, and there was that great big smile. It was him, Paul Bevilacqua. I said, I remember you. Beep. He said, yeah, that's me from the airplane. He says, you're hard to find. He said, do you know what happened to me? I said, I would love to know what happened to you. He said, you gave me that little gospel track. He said, I was headed off to game hunt, and I thought, this is far more important than big game hunting. And he took the track, and he says, I got down on my knees in front of those little seats in the airport with that little track. He said, I read the whole thing, and at the end it had this prayer, and he said, I called on the name of the Lord, and he said, I am saved, and you're my father. He says, you are my dad in the Lord. He said, you led me to Christ. And he started attending that church, and I baptized him and saw him. In fact, I just heard from him a few days ago. That's the truth we have that destroys the fear of death, that we're supposed to be here to share. And we're supposed to be purveyors of hope, of the gospel. Well, the second half of Revelation 20 is what happens to those that don't receive Christ. We should fear the holiness of Jesus. No scene in the Bible grips our minds and stirs our souls as much as these last verses of Revelation 20. You're supposed to learn the 15th verse. Imagine the scene. In one moment, all the angels and all the humans who've ever lived on the planet, as many as, and the United Nations says that 45 billion humans have lived on this planet since man evolved. Well, man didn't evolve, but maybe 45 billion have lived here. And they will be assembled in utter silence, and in the glow of God's glory surrounding his throne, all the dead, small and great, stand before God. You know what verse 15 says? And whoever's name was not found written in the book of life of the Lamb, written before the foundation of the world, was cast into the lake of fire. Fear the holiness of Jesus. Jesus spoke of hell more than heaven. In chapter 8 of Matthew and verse 12, he talks about this place of darkness and gnashing of teeth. Jesus, if you just do a statistical analysis and look every time he talked about heaven, you find a 2-for-1. He talked about hell 2 times for every 1 time about heaven. He warned of the horrors of eternal darkness. It says in Revelation 20, verses 1 and 2, that there's this bottomless pit. Jude adds that those who are thrown into it suffer the blackness of darkness falling forever. That's what a bottomless pit is. It's a lake of fire that is bottomless, and it's dark. It's not fire like we know it that's glowing. It's dark, and people are endlessly... Have you ever felt you're falling? Some people wake up in their dreams like they're falling, and we don't like to fall. We like solid ground under us. Can you imagine endlessly falling and never getting to the bottom? The horrors of eternal darkness. Why does this happen? Because God has the last word. And God's last word is Hebrews 9:27. Man is destined to die once, and after that face judgment. There's no reincarnation. There's no second chance. And there's no annihilation. It's eternal, endless, conscious, knowing that God is just. Because God says that he has knocked on the heart door of every person. You say, how do you know that? That's one of the, you know, on the Q&A Sunday nights that I've done for years, one of the questions people always come to the microphone is, what about the Aborigines and the Pygmies and the Native Americans that never had a missionary come to them? How can God condemn them? I said, well, there are 2 verses you should look at. The first one is in Psalm 19. And Psalm 19 says that he is the light, and he is the light that shines on everyone. In fact, John says he is the light that lighteth everyone that cometh into the world. Paul puts it this way in Romans chapter 1. He says that the eternal attributes of God are visible and everyone is without excuse. Everyone is born with 2 candles in their hands, the candle of creation and the candle of conscience. And that candle of creation, you know that there's this magnificent creation. I mean, if you found an iPhone on the ground, you wouldn't think that it just evolved there from sand turning to glass and, you know, aluminum coming up or whatever they're made of, and it just kind of formed over a long period of time. You would figure that someone made that. See, that's what the signature of God is. He's the creator. And his signature is he makes designs, these complex, intricate, beautiful things. And he wants us to look for him. Who made that iPhone, you know? Who made that galaxy? Who made that sea creature? Who made us? So that's the candle of creation. The candle of conscience is the conscience we have inside of us. Everyone's born with one. Is God's ally, and it's inside saying, you shouldn't be doing that, you shouldn't be doing that, I don't think that's a good idea. Everyone has one of those. I don't think you should do that. I don't think you should eat that person, cannibal. I don't think you should murder that person, murderer. I don't think you should do that. You know, conscience. And your conscience works until you do this, and you blow it out. And a lot of people have seared consciences. They say, I'm not going to listen to that conscience. And gradually, they don't. Then you still have this candle of creation. And what you do is you go, Acts 17 says, you hold it up and say, God, I would like to know who you are. You know what Acts 17 says when Paul was telling a bunch of Greeks that believed in evolution? He said, did you know the true creator God is within arm's length of every one of you? He actually says that in Acts 17. That God, an arm's length from this railing is this. So that means all I have to do is stretch my arm as far as it goes, and I'm at the railing. Paul said, God is an arm's length away. He said, you can grope. That's actually the word. You can reach out, and if you feel, you'll touch him. Every human, all 45 billion that have ever lived, God has stood this close to them. And he gave them, Romans 1 says, two candles, their conscience inside and creation out here. And if they took that candle and said, I sure would like to know who made all this, they actually will bump into God. That doesn't save them. But what it does is it starts the process of him revealing himself to them, and salvation is of the Lord. Well, Jesus goes on to describe hell in Mark 9:44. He says, the worm does not die, the fire is not quenched. There is this endless suffering. What's the worm that doesn't die? I think for many people, it's them remembering. I mean, I just shared the gospel with the Comcast man. He was trying to fix something at our home, and I went to him and I said, Tristan, thanks for all your hard work. I said, if my house collapsed on you today and you died, I always say that. And they go, you know, they look up if I have a bad ceiling or something. I said, I'm just using it as a metaphor. I said, where would you go? And he said, nowhere. He said, I don't believe in anything. He said, I'm a pagan. I said, can I share the gospel? And I guess because I was a customer, he went, okay. And I went through the whole gospel, gave him the track, and he said, you know what you just said, my mother made me listen to at Vacation Bible School. You know, he said, I'm not interested, though. He will remember that forever. If he persists and goes to hell, the worm that doesn't die, he will relive and relive and relive that moment when he stood in the entryway to our house. I told him about Jesus Christ, and Jesus was going, Tristan, I'm right here. I'm within arm's reach. Reach toward me. I will show myself to you. God has promised he's the light that lights every man, every human, every person. Jesus says so much in your notes. I put them, all the stuff Jesus said about hell, I put in there. There's more in your notes of what Jesus says about hell. In Matthew 13:30, he talks about the harvest and the grain and the unquenchable fire. Then the apostles add their warning. The best one is right here. Paul says this, knowing therefore the terror of the Lord, we persuade people. What does that mean? Why did I talk to Tristan? Why did I feel so bad on that airplane when I was ignoring the guy across the aisle? Because we know the terror of the Lord. We know that heaven is real and hell is real. And Paul said, I know that hell is so real, I want to persuade people. I want them to know Christ too. Okay, real quickly, we're finally in hour 10, and we have 36 minutes. So you're going to see time compression right now, okay? Number one, taste the joys of heaven. Revelation 21 and 22 are talking about heaven. When I was a little boy, there used to be a song in Sunday school, I'm going to heaven, can't wait, going to see Jesus, can't wait. Heaven is wonderful, bright, and fair. You know, on and on. We'd sing and we'd stomp and do this. That's how kids are. You tell them there's heaven, they go, ah, wow, sounds great to me. They get a little older and they say, it's a great idea. Got a lot to do here in life. You know, I want to get married, I want to have family, I want to travel, I want to do this and that. Heaven can wait. In fact, Dave Hunt, the Now with the Lord great prophetic writer, wrote a book, Heaven Can Wait. We slowly see earth more clearly than we see heaven. And that's why God wrote Revelation 21 and 22. He wants us to taste the joys of heaven. One of the things about heaven is the colors of heaven closely follow the breastplate on the high priest's chest. Those 12 stones representing the 12 tribes are very corresponding to the greens and the blues and purples and the reds of heaven. And again, it's another one of those Old Testament correspondences. But how is heaven described? Jesus said, in my Father's house are many mansions. Jesus promises us, not, there used to be, I've got a mansion just over the hillside, you know. in that bright land, I'll never grow old. And people start envisioning these gigantic houses down this main drag, and everybody gets one. That is not what the Bible says. In fact, the word, in my Father's house are many mansions, actually, that word in Greek is used in the Greek translation of the book of Genesis, of the ark, of the nest or resting places inside the ark that the animals each had. So really what the word means is not I'm going to have a gigantic mansion over there and you're going to have one over there and maybe I'll come go see you over there. It's we're in one big house or ark, our Father's big house, and we all have rooms of our own resting places that Jesus made specifically for us. It's very beautiful. What Jesus said is, it's a place that we're going to dwell. I go to prepare a place for you. It's a dwelling place that I want you to have. It is a place of eternal joy, a dwelling place. There are many dwelling places in his Father's house. Jesus even said this, and if I was teaching the Gospels, this is just part of the Gospels. He said, use your money on earth to make eternal friends so that in heaven they will welcome you into their everlasting habitation. Do you know why I told you that Bonnie and I love to support missionaries? Because the Bible says that if I support someone to go somewhere I could never go, and through my support that person goes there and leads someone to Christ, someday in heaven that person's going to come up and say, the Lord allowed me to know that the way the missionary got to my village and shared the gospel with me was you supported them, and I'd like you to come over to my house, and I want to tell you about how God marvelously worked in my village, and I came to Christ. You ever wonder what you're going to be doing in heaven? Part of it is God's going to connect all these pieces. Every track that you shared, everything you posted online and shared a word for Christ, every time you spoke up in school or in college or went out in open air like the 60 are doing right now, most of the time, we don't see what happens. In heaven, we will. And part of this Father's house is we have our own place that we will invite people to. You know, heaven is amazing. And if you read 21 and 22, it's a very real place. He said, if it wasn't so, I would have told you. He said, it's real. Heaven is not an idea. Heaven is emphatically a locale. You enter definite space. He says, you have forever your place in my house. In fact, in Revelation that I'm not teaching, chapters 1 through 5, there's a verse that says, all who are saved, the Father writes on them his name and the name of his place, the place they're going. In other words, when we got saved, God wrote the address on us. You know, you can take a piece of paper and write three lines of words, a name, a street address, and a city, state, and country. With three lines, you can send one piece of paper to any place on earth through the mail. God says, and they had mail back then, same, they understood this. He says, I've written my address on you. You're going to make it home to your place that I'm preparing for you. And it's a real place. It's not only real, it's permanent. Hebrews 11:10 says, these all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off. And they confessed and embraced that they had a city that had foundations. See, in the ancient world, shifting sands, floods, pillaging armies, earthquakes, and stuff went away. But they looked for a city that had foundations whose builder and maker is God. Heaven is permanent. We have a permanent home. I'm supposed to be camping here. This world is not my home. I'm a pilgrim. I'm a stranger. I'm always feeling unconnected, except to people, but not to this place. Because I know it's all going to burn. It's all going to be gone. It's going to be consumed and transformed. But I have a permanent place in heaven. Well, what's it like to enter heaven? And someone asked me about that during the break. They said, what about this soul sleep stuff? What about this idea of going unconscious and you know, there are the Advent Christian or whatever denomination it is believes in soul sleep. And they say that you die and you're in limbo. The Catholics believe in it too. They call it limbo. Actually, it's limbus infantum and limbus patrum is what they believe in. That's the Latin doctrinal terms, but it's not biblical. There is no limbo and there is no soul sleep. Look what Jesus said in Luke 23:43 to the thief on the cross. Jesus looked at him and said, "Today you are going to be with me in paradise." And that thief died in wonder. I mean, there was someone that couldn't wait to die. I mean, this guy was suffering and justly for his wickedness, and he believed on Christ. He looked at him, and Jesus said, "Today." He was the first one that Jesus brought into heaven. He was the last Old Testament saint. Because after the cross, the blood of the covenant, the new covenant, was enacted because the sacrifice was complete. And that man, today, no soul sleep. If the Lord tarries, every one of us in this room will cross through the valley of the shadow of death. And when that moment comes, Erwin Lutzer from Moody Memorial always talks about Corrie ten Boom, who used to say to her dad, "I'm afraid to die." And her dad says, "Hey, Corrie, when we're going on a train ride and you're a little girl, I don't want you to lose your train ticket, so I hold it until just before you get on the train and climb up those steps." And he said, "Did you know that just like that, God has dying grace for you that's going to carry you through that last step, but he doesn't give it to you so you don't lose it until just before you need it, and then he hands it to you like I give you the ticket." And Corrie ten Boom wrote in her memoir, she said, "That's what I shared with my sister Carrie as she died in the Nazi imprisonment." She said, "And that's what I cling to, that I'm going to enter heaven with the grace of God." Well, heaven is the place to be. Jesus said, "I go and prepare it for you, and I'm going to come back and take you to be with me, that where I am, there you may be also." So that's why we believe in the rapture. Jesus said, "The next time you see me, I'm coming to take you home. And I'm either going to come to you in your car accident or in the hospital or on the battlefield or, you know, in some big tragedy, or I'm going to come to you in the air and you're going to be drawn up and snatched up out of the earth. But I'm coming, as it says in John 14, 2 and 3, to take you to be with me that you may be where I am." And what is that event called? In Revelation 21, it's our marriage to Jesus. It's the bride's perfect home. All of us are engaged to Christ, Paul says in 2 Corinthians 11. We're betrothed to Christ. And he has gone, see, this is all biblical times, kind of the culture. A man would be betrothed to a woman, then the father would agree that she can marry him, and the guy would leave for about a year. And he'd go and add on to his parents' house. The parents lived in the big part, and he built this little part on the edge of his parents' house, a room for him and his wife to start their lives together. And it took him a lot of times, months, if not a year, to build this thing on. And he'd go and prepare a place, and then he'd come back, usually by torchlight, usually by night, and he'd walk back with all of his friends with the torches, and he'd come up to the father's, you know, the bride's dad's house, and they'd say, "The groom has come." And it would start a week-long celebration of the marriage feast. So Jesus uses all those biblical metaphors and says, "I'm engaged to you. I'm adding a room just for you on my father's house. And when it's done, I'm going to come and get you." I meet elderly people all the time that say, "Why is God letting me live so long? I'm 90 years old. I'm in the rest home, and I just want to go home." I said, "He's just not done with your room." That's really the answer. If we really look at heaven as home and earth as camping, we really get what God's talking about. What will the new heaven be like? 1 Corinthians 2:9 says, "Eye has not seen nor ear heard. It hasn't even entered into our hearts the things which God has prepared for those who love him." Can you imagine going around this incredible universe with the Creator himself? He loves us. We're his bride. We're engaged to him. He wants to thrill us forever. Heaven is better than anything you can imagine on earth. What will and will not be in heaven? Well, Revelation 21, 27 says, there will by no means enter anything that defiles. That's the wonderful thing about heaven. We were talking on the break. Someone said, if there are different rewards, that doesn't sound very good for heaven. Because, you know, like, this person will have a big reward and this person will have a little reward. I said, well, the difference is in heaven, all of the defilement of jealousy and rivalry is gone. I'm just so glad I'm there. I'm going to give the result of my life to the Lord. And before he wipes away my tears, I'm going to wish that I had more to give him. But he wipes away those tears in that moment. There's going to be a moment when everybody realizes how much time they really wasted. And it's going to break our heart. And then the Lord wipes away those tears and we don't think about that anymore. And there's no jealousy and rivalry and, you know, showing off. And we just cast before him. Nothing that defiles will be there. Only those who are in the eternal registry. That's what the book of life is, the eternal registry of the redeemed. Heaven will fulfill us forever. What does it say in Psalm 23:6? I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. I remember going to my grandmother's house, always going there. It was so good. The good food, the good everything. We just loved it. Can you imagine dwelling in our Father's house forever? What's the best part of heaven? John 14:3, Jesus said, we're going to be together. I think that's why the more you spend time in the Word, remember this deep and abiding love for Christ that only is satisfied by time in the Word, the more you do that, the more you fall in love with Christ. Because the best part of heaven is Christ. But what keeps us from loving him? I call this three worms. You can read that in your notes. I call them the sins of old age. Lust for comfort, lust for convenience, greed for recognition, covetousness for security. More people have missed God's best because they want comfort and convenience. They don't want discomfort and inconvenience. They want recognition instead of laboring with no one seeing them. They want security rather than saying, my life is in God's hands. They're also the problem of exceptionism, thinking your life is an exception to God's word. I meet people all the time. They say, oh, I know it says in the Bible that you're not supposed to do that, but that's for everybody else. They're an exception. They're not supposed to obey God. And finally, beware of unmortified pockets of pride in our life. Satan keeps us from the fruit we should bear. And you remember what it says in Revelation 3. Jesus said, come to me, because you're blind and naked and miserable and poor and you're wasting your life, and come to me. And that's what he wants us to do. The question is, will you hear Christ, well done? Really? Is that the longing of your heart? Finally, Revelation 21, 9 to 27 talks about how, and remember I told you this, and I'm going to, because this is on, by the way, this is on the exam. One question. Now remember, if the Bible is like 31,102 unconnected verses, then the book of Revelation is kind of like the picture on the front. So if Revelation is the picture, then it would be very important to understand it. Here's something that's in your notes. When they went through all the sermons of all the post-apostolic fathers, anti-Nicene fathers, Nicene fathers, and post-Nicene fathers. You say, who are all those? Those are all the pastors from the first, second, and third century. And many of them wrote their sermons out, and many of those sermons are still present in the world, and they have been translated. And when they translated them, you know what they found out? They looked at their sermons, and they looked at the verses they quoted in their sermons, and the verses they taught from in their sermons, and from those first three centuries, the entire book of Revelation could be reproduced from their sermons. It's the only book of the New Testament that every single word of it was taught in their churches. That's amazing. It's the first and the last books. Heaven 21:1 says everything is new, and there you can read in your notes. New heaven and earth, the wonders of that. This is interesting. We've always talked about the pearly gates. That's mentioned clearly in Revelation 21:12, great high wall with 12 gates, 12 angels at the gates. The names were written on them, which are the names of the 12 tribes of the children of Israel. What we find in heaven is this merging of the old and new people of God. The gates are the 12 tribes and the foundations of the 12 apostles. And that's where the old and the new coming together in one place to dwell with the Lord forever. There's also a new temple of worship. There's no building. It says in verse 21-22, I saw no temple in it, for the Lord Almighty and the Lamb are its temple. God says, Emmanuel, I want to be with you. And he is. But you know what he calls it? Paradise. Paradise always has had the idea of the ultimate place to go. And it says in 22:1-5 of Revelation, a pure river of the water of life. Now there's something in here some of you haven't caught, I wonder, yet. Proceeding from the throne of God and the Lamb, in the middle of the street, on either side, were the tree of life, which bore 12 fruits every month. Do you realize there will be the succession of time in heaven? You know, we sing the song, when the trumpet of the Lord shall sound, and time, what? Shall be no more. That isn't really biblical. When it says time shall be no more in Revelation, it doesn't mean time shall be no more that's ending. It means God's not waiting any longer, it's happening now. So the songwriter took that, and people have been kind of mindlessly singing this song and thinking there's no time in heaven. Oh, there's time in heaven. Every month, there are 12 different fruits growing on the tree of life, and they change. Every month, there's a new fruit. Do you know what that means? There's going to be variety. There's going to be change. There's going to be progression of time. One of the things we love to do is anticipate things. There are two amazing emotions humans all share, anticipation and reminiscence. We can't wait for things, and then we look back, and they get better than they were. When you reminisce, have you ever heard people tell stories like their fishing stories? They get bigger and bigger and bigger. The more we reminisce, it gets better, and the more we anticipate, the more we enjoy it. And heaven is going to have the progression of time. And we're going to look forward to the new things God's shown us, and the stuff he's shown us is going to get better and better. Heaven is perfect. It says in verse 5 of chapter 21, I make all things new. Perfect fellowship, perfect consolation. You can read that in your notes. Now, what's the moment we enter heaven? It's captured right here in the 116th Psalm. Yeah, that is a great psalm. Verse 15 says, precious in the sight of the Lord is the death of a saint. When they go from earth to heaven. And that's the wonder of entering heaven following Jesus. Well, the purpose of the book of Revelation is for all of us to fall in love with Jesus over again. And that's my goal for this course. Fall in love with Jesus over again. When the Bible opens in Genesis, we're transported to the Garden of Eden. When the Bible closes in Revelation 22, we're transported forward to the fringes of eternity and step back into the Garden of God. Jesus is extravagant. He makes all things new, and I told you that it's new, not different. Grass will not be blue. Water will not be yellow. It's going to be new of the same kind. That means anything that's wonderful. If you like color, boy, the colors in heaven are going to be amazing. If you like food, the food in heaven is going to be amazing. If you like adventure, wow. It's going to be better than snow camp, I can assure you, you know, going to heaven. It's amazing. All things are new. But look how Revelation ends in verse 17 of 22. And the Spirit and the bride say, come. Let him who's athirst say, come. Whoever desires, let him take the water of life freely. The celestial city is calling. See, that's God with his arms out. He's saying, come, 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 come. And we're supposed to be his ambassadors. Instead of turning our backs on people that are in the plane of life going to hell, we're supposed to turn around our seat and beg them. Say, God says, come. Revelation has many beatitudes. On your test, I remind you, this verse is going to be a question. Revelation is the only book in the Bible that comes with a promised blessing just for reading it. Did you know this is the only class you're going to take, other than Dr. Davis teaching the first part of Revelation, that you're getting blessed whether you like it or not? Just hearing the book of Revelation, just studying it, is so important to God, he pours out a blessing on anybody that is involved. This is on the test, and I want to go through this quickly. Remember this about worship, that it quickens our conscience, so His holiness nourishes our mind? Those five are a very difficult kind of matching thing. Do you know how you get it? Memorize this. He wants to quicken, that's make alive, our consciences. He wants to nourish and feed our minds. He wants to purify our imaginations. This is what worship can do in your life. He wants to open our hearts so we're compassionate, and He wants us to submit our wills. So learn the pairing that God wants to quicken our conscience. That's right out of the book of Hebrews. He wants to nourish our minds. That's right out of Matthew 4:4. He wants to purify our imaginations. That's 2 Corinthians 7:1. He wants to open our hearts. That's what Ephesians 1 says. And He wants us to submit our wills. That's Romans 12:1. And so those five, you need to get those pairings. It'll be on the test. Remember the Apostle John wrote five books with 50 chapters? So there'll be a question like, the Apostle John wrote three books with 22 chapters. And you say, what? Very good. See how smart you are? And there'll be something about the theme or purpose of Revelation is the unveiling. Worship is the submission of our whole nature to God, 72 hours. This thing, just think, Revelation opens with Christ in that vision. Then we go to the church, the churches that are at that moment. What he saw was Christ. And then Christ took him to what the things that are. And then after this, from 4 on through 22, is from the rapture to the very end. John wrote it, not Paul. The book of the Revelation was written last, you know, in the time of the Roman Emperor Domitian. The theme is the title. It's self-outlined, what I just showed you. It's the only book that comes with a blessing. Today, what you just labored through is going to be, again, you need to just know that outline. And I'm going to close with this. I have 2 minutes to say it. Galatians 2:20 says that I'm crucified with Christ, but I'm still alive. A lot of people struggle. What does that mean? The best illustration I know of it is driving a car. If I was out for a drive with you, and we were driving somewhere today, and all of a sudden I said, I'd like to surrender this car to you. You wouldn't know I meant it until I pulled the car over to the side, put it in park, turned it off, got out of the driver's seat, carried the keys around to your side of the car, opened the door for you, and said, here, you can drive now. I'm surrendering the direction of this car from now on to you. The one thing is to say, I'm going to do what you say, but I'm driving. Another thing is to pull over, park, shut it off, take the keys out, and present them back. That's what surrender is. That little paper, you know, that when you throw the stick on the fire and consecrate your life, and it says, all I am, all I ever be, I present. It's stopping the car of your life and saying, I'm going to pull over and hand you the keys. I'm going to get in the passenger seat. And I want not I, but Christ. Now, my question to you is, not, do you have one of those little stickers in the back of your Bible because you went forward? But once you surrender, you find out, I am wired to jump in the driver's seat every day and kind of start running my life. And I have to consciously, sometime in life, every day, pull over to the side, put it in park, take out the keys, and say, Lord, I'm sorry, I did it again. I started running everything. And take the keys out and hand it to Him. That is surrender. Who is the driver in your life? Thanks for listening. I hope you'll find us on Facebook. And there's our card, our missionary card. God bless you.